Chapter 17. Fridays, of which the following day was one, have special significance in the lands of Islam. Usually a holiday for everyone except barbers, who busily groom and perfume their festively dressed clients, Friday is known in Arabic as Yom al-Jum'ah, the day of the gathering. The gathering happens on Friday noons in the mosque, where the imam, in addition to usual prayers, delivers his weekly sermon. Even those who skip the prayers during the week tend to show up on Fridays, if only to trade gossip with acquaintances and follow up with a lazy meal. The Friday sermon, which can last as long as an hour, often delves into current events, explaining to the flock the nuances of national politics and the affairs of the world. In the centuries before radio, TV, and newspapers, these gatherings in the mosque provided the Muslim Ummah with a crucial source of news and official announcements. In the 1970s, thanks to radio and television, Muslims around the world could tune in every Friday to the most important of these sermons, the one delivered from the Grand Mosque in Mecca itself. Saudi radio and TV traditionally broadcast the Mecca speech live. On this Friday, November 23, 1979, Muslims worldwide held their breath as they waited for noon. After all, hadn't the Saudi government announced the day before that the holy shrine was now secure? Surely one of the learned ulama, maybe bin Baz himself, could offer thanks to the Almighty and explain the ghastly occurrences of recent days. But this time there was no broadcast from Mecca. The Friday prayer did not occur in the city's Grand Mosque for the first time in centuries. As an alternative, Saudi radio transmitted a sermon by the Imam of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Saleh. The Imam, while respected, was not one of the 30 topmost ulema, whose continued silence became increasingly puzzling. Men occupying the Grand Mosque, bin Saleh shrieked, were criminals exploiting the sanctity of the shrine to slaughter innocent people performing their devotions. A penalty was clear. Those who fight God and His Prophet and endeavor to spread corruption on earth deserve to be killed or crucified, or have their hands and legs cut off. The Imam of the Grand Mosque of Riyadh, and one of the descendants of Ibn Abdel Wahhab, Abdulaziz al-Sheikh, took an equally stern line. Juhayman's men, he bellowed in his noon sermon, had earned themselves the curse of God and man. To millions of Muslims worldwide, the absence of a Friday sermon from Mecca came as a shock. It meant that Saudi assurances of having restored control to the sacred precinct had been a blatant lie. And if this was a falsehood, what about Saudi guarantees of American innocence in the affair? In sermons that cascaded around the Middle East and Asia, anti-American fury was stoked once again. And, as worshippers dispersed after the prayers, fired up by foamy-mouthed imams who conjured dark conspiracies against God's religion, violent demonstrations resumed with new vigor. Though Pakistan remained relatively calm, some 10,000 people rampaged that Friday through the streets of the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka, chanting, "Death to America." The mob's intention was to break into the American embassy and to finally set it alight. The Saudi ambassador to Bangladesh, who himself knelt for prayers in Dhaka's main mosque that noon, saved the day by addressing the crowd. The robed envoy managed to convince at least some of the faithful that neither America nor Iran had anything to do with the Mecca upheaval. Things didn't go as smoothly in the nearby capital of Indian Bengal, Calcutta. There, the opposition Indian National Congress faction of the former Premier Indira Gandhi was actively courting the Muslim minority in an upcoming election. Joining the anti-American chorus seemed a guaranteed vote-getter, and so the faction helped organize a Friday protest outside the U.S. consulate. At the rally, eloquent speeches about an American Zionist plot to destroy the shrines of Islam electrified the mob. Protesters rushed toward the consulate, pelting with rocks a protective ring of police. Unlike Pakistani troopers 2 days earlier, Indian security men held forth, firing tear gas into the crowd. 8 policemen and scores of demonstrators were injured in the scuffles. Driven away from the consulate, the mob vented its anger by vandalizing Calcutta's storefronts and torching parked cars and buses. An unlucky Frenchman happened to be driving by. Attacked by the mob, he was dragged out of his vehicle just before it became a fireball. Unlike in Calcutta, there were no Westerners to attack in the southern Indian city of Hyderabad, so following the Friday sermon there, Muslim radicals turned on their Hindu neighbors. Hyderabad's Muslim merchants, following the Pakistani example, had shuttered their stores in the old city and proclaimed a strike to protest the profanation of Mecca. The Hindu stores stayed open, at least until outraged Muslim mobs tried to loot and burn them. Dozens of people were injured on Friday, and a curfew was proclaimed. Communal violence continued for days. The mayhem ended only after security forces deployed en masse, making more than 1,000 arrests. A different kind of violence germinated in Turkey. A new Catholic pope, John Paul II, was about to arrive there for a visit with his Orthodox counterpart, Istanbul-based Patriarch Demetrios. The trip, planned well in advance, aimed to bridge a schism that had begun almost a millennium earlier, when the Catholic pope and the Orthodox patriarch excommunicated each other, dividing the Christian world into two hostile halves. Muslim-Christian relations were not supposed to be an issue, but the recent outbreak of Islamic fervor across the region frightened Turkish authorities. This is not the right time for the pope to be visiting Turkey. This visit puts Turkey into a difficult situation with the rest of the Muslim world, the Islamist-leaning Yankee magazine warned its readers. Fearing street protests, the government tried its best to keep the pope's trip as low-key as possible. The planned visit still infuriated many Turkish radicals, including one who was kept behind bars in Istanbul's maximum security Kartal Maltepe military prison. A nationalist and an Islamist, Mehmet Ali Aksa had been imprisoned earlier that year for killing the editor of Milliyet, a popular left-leaning newspaper. The night of November 24th, Aksa, apparently helped by an accomplice among the guards and disguised in a military uniform, managed to escape. Then, he tauntingly dispatched to Milliyet a handwritten letter that explained his motives. Parroting Khomeini's conspiracy theories, Aksa lamented in the note the desecration of Mecca's Grand Mosque as an American and Zionist outrage against Islam. "The U.S. and Israel are responsible, and they will pay for this," Aksa scribbled. A visit to Muslim Turkey by the Pope was part and parcel of the same infidel plot, he wrote. "The Western imperialists are afraid that Turkey's brotherly Islamic countries in the Middle East will create a new political, military, and economic superpower, and are sending the Pope, a leader of the Crusaders who is masquerading as a man of faith, to Turkey at a very wrong time." To redeem Muslim honor and wash off the stain of humiliation in Mecca, Aksa pledged in the letter, which Milliyet duly printed on its front page, to personally assassinate the Catholic pontiff. "If the visit is not called off, I will definitely kill him." A year and a half later, on the cobbled Piazza San Pietro in Rome, Aksa would attempt to make good on this threat. Firing point blank as John Paul II's vehicle passed nearby, he discharged 3 bullets from his 9mm Browning pistol. Just narrowly skirting vital organs, one of these bullets burst through the pontiff's abdomen, almost killing him. Amid all this fury, Mark Hambly, the young Arabic-speaking political officer at the American Embassy in Jeddah, embarked on a mission that was hazardous in the extreme. Ambassador West, still puzzled by the contradictions between various reports on the fighting in Mecca, felt that he badly needed to know what exactly was going on inside the holy shrine. Mecca, because of the natural attraction that forbidden fruits always exert, has long captured the imaginations of adventurous Westerners. From Sir Richard Burton to T.E. Lawrence, the more entrepreneurial ones have managed to penetrate the city's sacred boundaries in Arab disguise. A collector of carved Arabian doors and an avid student of Islamic culture, Hambly believed that his Yemeni accent and knowledge of local ways put him, too, in a unique position to sneak into the holy city undetected. Colonel Ryer, his partner in debriefing the American chopper pilot, could come along for backup as long as he remained silent. This kind of covert operation was extremely risky. The last thing the United States could afford in those days, as outlandish conspiracy theories provoked American deaths, was for an infidel American diplomat to be caught red-handed as he defiled Mecca's sacred soil with his presence. But ignorance of the truth about Saudi Arabia's worst security crisis in decades also presented dangers. The recent collapse of Iran illustrated to everyone the perils of overestimating an allied regime's stability. And, as had been the case with Iran, CIA spooks in Saudi Arabia provided frustratingly little information. Details of the incident are still sparse, in part because of Saudi reluctance to discuss the problem openly, and in part because Mecca is off-limits to non-Muslims, one agency memorandum confessed at the time. The situation in Mecca remains unclear, admitted another. Ambassador West, safe in his friendship with Carter, decided in the end that he could, and should, authorize a quick trip to Mecca for an embassy employee or two, without necessarily informing the jittery State Department brass back in Washington. Soon thereafter, Hambly and Ryer, sporting Arab dress, melted into an influx of worshippers who, encouraged by reports of a government victory, clogged the roads toward the holy city. The ruse worked. The two managed to approach the Grand Mosque's vicinity, driving past outlying Mecca neighborhoods that bustled with unexpectedly normal activity. Extracting a camera, Hambly snapped graphic pictures of the fighting that obviously still continued around the shrine, and then hurried back. The mission was a success. Their cover wasn't blown. Because the embassy's communications equipment took forever to transmit photographs, this pictorial evidence never reached State Department officials. Hours later, it became irrelevant. Reliable photo intelligence began to arrive from SR-71 high-altitude strategic reconnaissance planes that had been dispatched to circle above Mecca. Hambly and Ryer pondered in following days whether they should make a fortune by selling these exclusive photographs of the fighting in Mecca to Time or Newsweek. They decided against such a move. Their close friends and colleagues still remained captive in Tehran, and the release of such highly sensitive photographs by an American magazine could have rekindled Khomeini's conspiracy theories, jeopardizing the hostages' safety. The American hostages' fate, as well as the ramifications of Islamist violence that now infected Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, monopolized President Carter's attention. At 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Friday, November 23rd, the morning after Thanksgiving, the President greeted his senior advisors, Brzezinski, Vice President Mondale, Secretary of State Vance, Defense Secretary Brown, and the CIA Director, Stansfield Turner, at the Camp David helipad. Then they all retreated to the red brick Laurel Lodge for a 2-hour debate. Just as the National Security Council gathering 3 days earlier, the continuing standoff in Mecca was still seen by top administration officials as a data point in America's escalating confrontation with Iran. Despite well-informed cables from Ambassador West in Jeddah, the assumption that Shiite militants were involved one way or another still held. The CIA added to this mistaken perception, warning in a memo that Khomeini was seeking to exploit the situation at the expense of the U.S., and that Iran had started broadcasting the Ayatollah's inflammatory speeches in Arabic to Saudi Arabia's Shiite minority. From Tehran, the American chargé d'affaires Bruce Langan, who continued to hide in the Iranian Foreign Ministry building, had managed to pass a confidential message to Vance the previous night. Langan's language betrayed the stress of recent days. "The public atmosphere here is one of dangerous emotional frenzy," Langan reported. "Khomeini and his entourage of clerics have skillfully used the seizure of our embassy to develop a mass psychology of hate that may have few parallels in history." With American lives now lost to Khomeini-sponsored hysteria over the Mecca upheaval in Pakistan, and with American hostages in Tehran facing trials and possible execution, President Carter asked administration officials gathered in Camp David to explore America's options. The violence in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, on the heels of Khomeini's statements about trials and punishments for our hostages, were grave threats to world peace, the president later described his thoughts. Hawks, led by Brzezinski, believed it was time to prepare for action, blockading Iranian trade, bombing the Abadan oil terminals, or maybe even seizing an Iranian island. They brought along aerial photographs of Iranian refineries and other strategic targets. Carter, a retired U.S. Navy lieutenant, pored over these pictures, scrutinized maps and charts of coastal waters, and suggested mining the entrances of all Iranian seaports. Mondale and Vance disagreed, insisting on a softer approach. The Secretary of State, who believed that it was still possible to reason with Khomeini, opposed any public threats to Iran and even objected to Carter's suggestion to expel Iranian diplomats. Carter, as he usually did in the early stages of the Tehran hostage crisis, followed Vance's advice. Later that day, the president sent to Iran a stern, but confidential message via several allied governments. He warned Khomeini that the United States would blockade Iran if American hostages were put on trial and retaliate militarily if they were harmed. Iranian diplomats were allowed to remain undisturbed in the United States. Traumatized by the loss of embassies in Tehran and Islamabad, Vance appeared to his administration colleagues as increasingly gloomy in these hours, succumbing to what one of them described as a grim and fatalistic attitude. Above all, the Secretary of State was determined to protect the lives of American diplomats still remaining in the region. The persistence of the myth of American involvement in Mecca, as shown by the rioting that had now spread to Turkey, India, and Bangladesh, made him realize that American embassies had become sitting ducks all over the region. He didn't want to receive another nighttime call about yet another American mission overrun overseas to the chance of Allahu Akbar. So, on this Thanksgiving weekend, Vance followed the pullout of American personnel from Pakistan with a move to evacuate the bulk of American diplomatic presence elsewhere in the Muslim world. This, he explained, would forestall other hostage situations from developing and make it easier for local authorities to protect remaining Americans. Several hundred non-essential personnel and dependents were flown home from across the Middle East. American embassies in the region, with the notable exception of the one in Saudi Arabia, became isolated, empty shells. The move didn't go unnoticed among Muslim radicals. A chain of events unleashed by the takeover in Mecca had put America on the run from the lands of Islam. America's foes drew a conclusion that Osama bin Laden would often repeat: when hit hard, America flees. Dragging its tail in failure, defeat, and ruin, caring for nothing. Precisely these feelings caused considerable dismay about Vance's decision among the staff of Brzezinski's National Security Council. Paul Hens, a Middle East scholar and former CIA Turkey station chief who served as one of Brzezinski's top advisors, fired off a perplexed and in many ways prophetic memo to his boss. Rather than demonstrating to the world that we break and run under pressure, we would serve our own interests better if we displayed a stubborn insistence on staying in place, asserting ourselves and being ready to fight. Let the Marines shoot! To defend our installations and our principles when challenged, he wrote. We are well on our way to being cast as anti-Islamic in most of the Muslim world. Local demagogues find such tactics expedient, and their appetites are whetted every time we look weak. Hens found it appalling that the Soviets, who had been viciously oppressing Islam in their own territories for 60 years, and who now sponsored a communist regime battling Islamist insurgents in Afghanistan, had managed to capitalize on America's predicament to such an extent that they began to emerge with an enhanced image as protectors of Islamic nationalism in the Middle East. What has been happening in Iran, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia has pushed Afghanistan far into the background. By showing vacillation and weakness, Hens warned, the administration's response so far was dangerous. It contributes exactly to what our enemies most want to see. We isolate ourselves from the Muslims, mutual suspicions grow, and permanent alienation sets in. If we do not stem this process, the Carter administration will have left its successors a legacy that will require many years to eliminate. Chapter 18. By the end of Friday, November 23rd, the 30 senior Saudi ulema finally agreed on the text of the long-awaited fatwa, authorizing the government to act. The untenable silence was broken, and not a minute too soon. Islamic clerics worldwide had already shown unanimity in condemning Juhayman's reckless usurpation of the shrine, and it looked as though the Saudi state, chastened by the battering its soldiers received at the Grand Mosque the previous day, needed all the help it could get. Unlike government statements and pronouncements by Muslim clerics abroad, the ruling by the Saudi ulema eschewed flowery language. It didn't even describe Juhayman's men occupying the Grand Mosque as renegades or deviants. Instead, the ulema employed the strikingly mild appellation of an armed group. First of all, the document said, the rebels inside the shrine must be asked to surrender and lay down their arms. Should the militants agree, they must be imprisoned until their case is considered in accordance with the Islamic Sharia. But if the rebels resisted, the ulema determined, All measures could be taken to arrest them, even if it led to a fight and the killing of those who were not arrested and had not surrendered. To justify this binding legal decision, the ulama cited a Quranic verse that waives the traditional ban on using weapons in the holy precinct. Do not fight with them at the sacred mosque until they fight with you in it. But if they do fight you, then slay them. Such is the recompense of the unbelievers. This last clause caused something of a theological conundrum, for the ulama knew that Juhayman and his men were Muslim, manifestly not unbelievers. So, alongside the fatwa, the learned scholars felt the need to issue a non-binding explanatory statement. Although this verse has been revealed in connection with the infidels, its connotations include them and those who acted like them. The ulama, therefore, unanimously agreed that fighting inside the sacred mosque has become permissible, the statement said. It was a lesson that future generations of radicals would never forget. If Muslims like Juhayman could be branded as infidels because of their actions, so too could American allies across the Islamic world, the Saudi royal family included. The fatwa's publication meant that the gloves were now off. Up until then, the government's paramount concern was not to damage the Grand Mosque, something that could inflame religious sensibilities and even undermine support from the clerics. Now the Saudi state no longer had to worry about theological cover. It could finally unleash on Juhayman's rebels the full might of the latest American and European weaponry, purchased by the kingdom with billions of dollars in oil proceeds. The bloody battles of recent days made it clear. This was open warfare, not a policing action. The regular army had to be in command. General Tahiri was placed at the helm of the task force, and his King Abdulaziz armored brigade called into action. The army's fleet of U.S.-built M113 armored personnel carriers and artillery support finally rumbled into the Grand Mosque's vicinity. Recognizing that numerous casualties would be unavoidable, Saudi officials ordered all Muslim doctors and staff at Jeddah's military hospital to travel to Mecca with an overnight bag. Matani, the stranded Egyptian professor, was awakened in the Africa Hotel by the noise of the APCs, trucks, and ambulances that poured into the area. Once he looked outside, he noticed that the mosque was no longer in the dark. Military floodlights turned night into day. Troops lay in the prone position on the ground. Weapons pointed at the sacred enclosure. For several hours, a military jeep with mounted loudspeakers circled around the Grand Mosque's compound, broadcasting a surrender message that had been requested by the ulema. To all those who are underground and inside the mosque, we warn you so that you can save your souls. Surrender, or we shall force you to do so. You have to surrender and head to the central part of the courtyard. Those who surrender will not be harmed. Surrender. Matani wrote in his notebook that he saw no one answering this call. The new force's first mission was to suppress Juhayman's snipers, who continued to inflict unacceptable casualties from the minaret tops. The best shots, such as Ridan al-Humidian, a relative of Juhayman's from Sajr, and Igab al-Mahia, another Sajr native, by now had achieved legendary status among fellow rebels. These snipers even nearly killed General Tahiri himself, firing a bullet that grazed the general's cheek just as he peeked out of a top-floor window in the Imarat al-Ashraf tower that faced the minarets. Solidly built and each containing two cup-like balconies that shielded their occupants from fire from below, the minarets also provided the gunmen with embrasure-style windows halfway upstairs. This protection posed a military problem that couldn't be resolved without heavy weaponry. The only way to drive down the snipers, military commanders decided, was by lobbing into the minarets American-made missiles known as TOWS, an acronym for tube-launched, optically tracked, wire command-linked, guided. Designed to be used against tanks, the TOWS packed a powerful payload that went off with a deafening bang upon hitting the marble of the balconies. On impact, a spray of jagged shrapnel and bright orange fire engulfed rebel snipers as plumes of thick smoke began to obscure the minaret tops. No one remained alive in the gun nests. The sturdy minarets themselves withstood this rocketing, with only balcony balustrades caving in. Below, in the streets around the mosque, M113s, boxy, threaded vehicles with 50-caliber machine guns mounted on the roofs, prepared for the ground invasion. The plan was to drive these nimble APCs into the mosque's wide passageways, blasting out the gates and securing the inner courtyard around the Kaaba. As in the early days of the operation, the attack was to be carried out by three different forces: the Saudi Army, the National Guard, and the Interior Ministry's Special Security Forces, all of whom reported to different masters despite theoretically unified command. Prince Sultan, the defense minister, remained in the Shubra Hotel, while Prince Nayef, the Minister of the Interior, set up alternative headquarters in the Mecca Hotel west of the mosque. Prince Abdullah, the National Guard commander, ran the operation from Riyadh without actually coming to the holy city. Crown Prince Fahd, who had returned from Tunis, also stayed away, barking down orders from his coastal palace in Jeddah. By then, Salem bin Laden had finally come up with the maps and blueprints of the mosque, giving the planners more clarity about the shrine's internal structure. As military commanders scrutinized these documents, General Tahiri decided that his armored troops would keep on pushing into the Marwa Safa Gallery, advancing from there into the depths of the mosque. The National Guard and the Interior Ministry's Special Security Force were to move toward each other in an interlocking ring through the main perimeter of the compound that encircled the Kaaba. As the new offensive began, F-5 fighter jets roared atop the compound, flying just above ground in a show of intimidation that made the buildings vibrate. Shelling made part of the gallery's sidewall collapse, exposing its interior. The initial attack concentrated on the gallery's upper level, with M113 carriers pouring in from the blasted-out gates and through the new side opening. Infantry troops crouched behind the slowly moving APCs, the armor of which shielded the men from rebel bullets, and unloaded their guns into the darkness inside. It was almost like fighting ghosts, some soldiers felt. The rebels, who smeared black soot over their faces, were invisible. Only muzzle flashes indicated their positions. The floor was slippery because of blood and human entrails, leftovers of earlier fighting. Rebels hid behind the ancient rocks of Safa and behind the brand new columns and parapets built by bin Laden. Some rolled themselves into thick woolen carpets that abounded in the area and fired upward as troops passed nearby. Because of this unusual angle of fire, a disproportionate number of troops sustained wounds in their lower body. Mohammed Abdullah, the supposed Mahdi, was at the forefront of this battle. He fully believed himself to be more than just a mere mortal, and therefore behaved as if he were impervious to bullets, and indeed he seemed to be charmed, emerging unscathed from salvos of gunfire again and again. The introduction of armored vehicles into the gallery changed the rules of the battle, for the first time providing an edge to government forces. While the Interior Ministry commandos and the National Guard faced stiff resistance elsewhere in the compound, here rebels began to retreat. Bullets from their rifles bounced harmlessly off the APC's armor. The gunmen didn't possess anything like the TOW missiles that had just pulverized the snipers' nests atop the minarets. The M113s had to be stopped at all costs. Mohammed Abdullah decided he would be the one to destroy them. As others tried to discourage him, he smiled back calmly. "I am the Mahdi, and I do not fear anything. I cannot die." With a canister of petrol and a flaming piece of cloth in his hands, he dodged the bullets and sprinted toward the nearest APC. Miraculously, once again he received nary a scratch, pouring petrol on the vehicle and setting the liquid ablaze. The fire, however, failed to disable the APC. The carrier turned back and roared away to safety outside the gallery. Juhayman, undeterred, proposed a different plan. Some rooms inside the shrine's basement, the Kabu, had been used as living quarters by staff and students of the Grand Mosque Academy. They were equipped with rudimentary kitchens and had stoves powered by metallic cooking gas cylinders. On Juhayman's orders, fellow rebels rolled these cylinders into the Marwa Safa Gallery, planning to thrust them under the threads of the APCs and trigger an explosion. But as more and more APCs entered the gallery, their machine guns clattering without stop, the rebels found it impossible to shove these cylinders close enough to their targets. The plan didn't work. Rebels were more lucky in the lower level of the gallery. There, an APC tried to drive in through one of the blasted-out gates. The clearing was just tall enough for the APC's main body to squeeze through, but not for the antenna tower at the back of the vehicle. With its nose already indoors, the vehicle stalled and then got stuck, held back by the antenna. Thread started excavating the ground as the nervous driver hit the gas. Rebels who lurked nearby seized their opportunity. Thrusting rolled carpets into the threads of the APC, they locked the vehicle in place. Then they tried a new tactic, taught by an African-American convert who remembered recipes from the Anarchist Cookbook. Pilgrims had abandoned hundreds of glass bottles by the holy source of Zamzam under the mosque. Filled with gasoline and stuffed with a piece of cloth that served as a fuse, these became fearsome Molotov cocktails. Though rudimentary, such firebombs could disable sophisticated American-made fighting machines. As the hapless M113 remained stuck at the gate, one of the rebels jumped on the roof, lit the fuse, opened the hatch, and threw a flaming Molotov cocktail inside. Seconds later, the insides of the APC turned into a blazing oven. The unlucky crew was carbonized in a flash of fire. Rebels rejoiced with a powerful cry of Allahu Akbar. Molotov cocktails now also started to rain on the M113s in the upper gallery. Some went up in flames. Panicked crews turned their vehicles to escape the kill zone. The APC driver's field of vision is by necessity limited. In this rush to safety, they trampled several of their own men. Unfortunate soldiers who happened to be in the way were mashed up by the carrier's threads. At the lower level gate, the carbonized APC still blocked the way, hampering the offensive. It was Captain Abu Sultan's job to try to remove the burned-out hulk. On the streets of Mecca, he rounded up a Pakistani construction worker with a bulldozer and got him to drive toward the Grand Mosque. Near the shrine, rebel bullets began to whiz by. The frightened Pakistani jumped out and ran. Cursing, Abu Sultan climbed into the driver's seat, steering the bulldozer toward the back of the APC. Once his men attached a towing chain to the armored vehicle, the captain put the bulldozer in reverse, pulling out the wreck and unclogging the gate. The soldiers pressed on. As they penetrated deeper and deeper into the mosque, they discovered a terrifying scene. Body parts coated the ground. Some of the rebel dead appeared to be deliberately defaced, their heads doused in gasoline and torched by fellow conspirators in order to make identification impossible. After days in the heat, some of the cadavers had now turned into sludgy mounds of rotten flesh. The sweet, putrid stench of death mixed in the air with the smell of cordite, urine, and stifling smoke from the fires. Government troops had been given orders not to shoot in the direction of the sacred Kaaba and to avoid hitting children, women, and civilians. This was the order of priorities. Protecting the house of God came before human lives. General Tahiri's biggest fear, as he recounted it later, was that Juhayman's men would use as a fortified stronghold the Kaaba itself, a windowless stone structure that would be impossible to conquer without major damage. But Juhayman shared most Muslims' belief about the sacredness of the site, and, with some exceptions, his men concentrated on fighting Saudi forces in more modern parts of the mosque. In the confusion of battle, where every moving shadow meant likely death, orders to spare the civilians were not easy to follow. With scores of comrades now dead, Saudi troopers squeezed the trigger whenever they spotted any motion in the darkness. This led to predictable tragedies. Once the offensive began to overwhelm the rebels, scores of hostages tried to run out and toward the advancing troops, only to be mistaken for militants and mowed down. Lethal firefights also erupted between the Saudi army, the Special Security Force, and the National Guard, who all operated with separate radio systems and mistook one another's men for rebels. No matter. As Prince Nayef had said, any Muslim killed while liberating the mosque was an envied martyr who had now earned a fast-track promotion to paradise. By mid-Saturday, the armored offensive finally cleared out the Marwa Safa Gallery, opening the way to the main courtyard. Abu Sultan returned to the shrine in a new APC. He made it all the way to the center of the plaza, near the Kaaba. Though minarets were now secure, Juhayman's snipers still operated on the upper floors of the mosque that ringed the courtyard. As he crossed the plaza, leaving thread marks on the marble, a staccato of bullets, unable to penetrate the APC's armor, tapped the vehicle's surface like heavy rain. Three Egyptian militants were shooting at the approaching vehicle from behind the C-shaped wall, the Rukin, that contained the holy remains of Hagar and Ishmael. The heavy machine gun of Abu Sultan's APC fired back, killing two of the Egyptians. As Abu Sultan's vehicle inched closer, he noticed that the third Egyptian militant was still alive, his legs shredded by 50-caliber bullets and soaked in blood. Like some of the rebels, the Egyptian wore the ihram, the pilgrim's outfit made of two white strips of cloth.
"Help me! Help me!"
the man cried as Abu Sultan opened the hatch.
"Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I'm just a pilgrim!"
Abu Sultan had his doubts. He spotted a Kalashnikov rifle next to the man's hands.
"Come down! Please help me!"
the Egyptian continued to cry.
"Please help me!"
The captain thought better. Leaving the APC's armor would be clearly suicidal. He threw a rope from the hatch, shouting,
"Hold this!"
The Egyptian grasped at the rope, and the APC slowly drove back, dragging the prisoner behind and leaving a trail of dark red blood from his hemorrhaging legs on the marble. American pilots ferrying GID officers on a reconnaissance sortie above the Grand Mosque's courtyard witnessed the final hours of this assault firsthand. Two more Saudi APCs, Dan reported to American diplomats, rumbled onto the plaza around the Kaaba at 3:30 p.m., spraying the outer ring of buildings with rapid fire. This hailstorm of bullets riddled the walls, causing severe damage. Plumes of black smoke rose from the ramparts as a result of this fusillade, and a giant fire began to swallow the Marwa Safa gallery area and the Fatah gate zone between the twin minarets. From outside the mosque compound, civilian fire trucks tried to prevent this inferno from spreading into adjoining neighborhoods, dousing the gallery with water. Journalists at Mecca's local newspaper, Al Nadwa, had a perfect view of the fireworks from their desks. While other reporters were barred from the area, Al Nadwa's photographers rushed to snap the dramatic pictures. The photos were splashed the next morning across the front page. The Saudi government, angry about such adverse publicity, had most outstanding copies of the newspaper recalled. As this battle raged on Saturday, Ambassador West and much of the top American embassy brass flew to Riyadh, accompanying visiting Treasury Secretary G. William Miller. Their initial meetings with Oil Minister Yamani and other mid-level officials were businesslike, but a late-night appointment with King Khaled and Prince Abdullah turned into a disaster. At the ambassador's suggestion, Miller started out by expressing regret about the desecration of the Grand Mosque. "That set the king off," West wrote in his diary. He started chattering to Abdullah, and they started going back and forth in Arabic. A junior American diplomat tried to interpret, but the monarch cut him off every time he opened his mouth. The two Saudi royals kept arguing about the Grand Mosque for a half hour, with Ambassador West and Secretary Miller unable to understand a single word. "We got one thing out of the meeting. Namely, the king was terribly upset at what had happened in Mecca," the ambassador jotted down afterwards. Chapter 19. Between Saturday and Sunday, most of the rebels retreated from the mosque's surface and into the Kaaba underground. Only a small group of zealots made a last stand in the shrine's burning corridors. Defying death, once again, was the supposed Mahdi, Muhammad Abdullah. His long hair matted and speckled with blood, the young man chose a new way of demonstrating his immortality. Government soldiers now tossed one hand grenade after another to clear passageways on their path. Whenever Muhammad Abdullah heard the unmistakable clink of a metal grenade hitting the marble, he ran to pick up the munition. Then, in the fraction of seconds that remained before the explosion, he hurled it back at the soldiers. Time after time he succeeded in returning these lethal devices to their senders. Finally, he ran out of luck. Just as Muhammad Abdullah prepared to scoop up yet another grenade, it exploded, turning parts of his lower torso and legs into carbonized goo. Cowering under barrages of fire, fellow rebels were unable to rescue their Mahdi, who writhed in agony amid the toxic haze. He was left behind on the battlefield. If not already dead, fellow fighters concluded, then most likely mortally wounded. The fire that blazed in the Grand Mosque was mostly extinguished by Sunday morning, as Dan flew his Chinook once again above the compound. 5 of the shrine's 7 minarets, he observed, had been shelled. Most of the gates lay on the floor, blown off hinges. Almost all windows facing the mosque's inner courtyard had been smashed in. In spooky silence, some 60 Saudi soldiers milled in a corner of the courtyard. Another 75 or so could be seen on a roof. Above-ground resistance seemed crushed. The capture of the mosque's surface momentarily buoyed morale among Saudi soldiers. Major Nafai of the Special Security Force, the man who had drawn up the assault plans, finally felt he could steal a few hours of sleep after staying awake for 5 days in a row. The handful of rebels who remained isolated in the mosque's corridors, cut off from staircases that led to the Kaaba, had been taken prisoner and began providing valuable intelligence. In his hotel room, Professor Mattani watched 2 gunmen jump from the mosque's upper windows to be immediately surrounded by troops and spirited away. 12 other suspects, including 3 women, were spotted in chains in a holding area of Jeddah's military airport, awaiting a transport flight to Riyadh. For the first time since the assault began, senior Saudi princes ventured in person into the sacred compound. Donning military fatigues, the intelligence chief, Prince Turki, his brother, the foreign minister, Prince Saad al-Faisal, General Tahiri, and the indomitable Salem bin Laden penetrated the mosque, keeping their heads low in case more rebel gunmen remained undetected. As he surveyed the damage, Prince Turki noticed dead bodies sprawled in the corridors. But these didn't disturb him as much as the eerie, unnatural quiet in the usually crowded shrine. Never before had he seen the Grand Mosque so empty of people. It was not so much the visual evidence of fighting that struck him, Prince Turki later recalled, as a lingering aura of the evil that he knew had occurred there. It was clear to him and other senior Saudi officials that more bloody battles loomed ahead. As military commanders examined bin Laden's blueprints, they realized that the basement labyrinth, a veritable underground city, would be a much harder target to conquer than the shrine's surface structures. Since the first hours of the siege, Juhayman had been using this underground as his headquarters, and it was there that he had stockpiled ammunition, weapons, and food. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the defense minister's son and future Saudi envoy to Washington, told Ambassador West in those hours that bin Laden ought to be given a medal and then shot. Because of the construction work's superior quality, even tow missiles couldn't break the sturdy gates that led into the Grand Mosque's basement, and the structure's maze of caverns and pillars made it ideal for hand-to-hand fighting. Saudi rulers were particularly concerned that the Kaaba's network of cisterns, caves, and storage rooms might be connected via secret passageways with mountainsides on the outskirts of the city. On Sunday, the government deployed a fleet of helicopter gunships to patrol the desert around Mecca, seeking out anyone attempting to escape the compound or to smuggle in reinforcements. Busy defending approaches into the Kaaba and battered by the government offensive, Juhayman's rebels no longer had the time or manpower to watch over their prisoners of war. Shackled members of the Grand Mosque police and officers like Lieutenant Kudebi, the paratroop platoon commander captured during Thursday's ambush in the Marwa-Safa tunnel. Locked in a small basement cell, Lieutenant Kudebi and a fellow captive paratrooper, whose chest wound kept deteriorating, were left alone with a bottle of water. They didn't see their guards for 3 days. Only 4 meters, about 13 feet, of corridor separated the cell's door from a staircase that led to freedom above ground. On Sunday, as fighting raged just outside, soldiers' shouts were clearly audible to the 2 captives. Trying to smoke out the rebels, Saudi forces now began to fire round after round of tear gas canisters into the basement. The gas didn't spread deep into the Kaaba, however, and the rebels quickly learned to filter it out by dipping their headdresses in water and breathing through the wet cotton. Lieutenant Kudebi and his comrade, caught in the middle of the tear gas cloud that wafted into the cell, had no such protection. The lieutenant was already feeling sick as his infected wounds resumed bleeding. Now he was overwhelmed by an intense burning in the eyes, nostrils, and mouth, panting for breath. The 2 officers reckoned they would die in this cell if they didn't try to escape. Later on Sunday, they found a metal rod among the debris and managed to pry open the door. "We are fellow soldiers. Come bring us out," Lieutenant Kadavy shouted toward the invisible troops up the staircase. "Come here with stretchers!" Juhayman's men were not far away. Hearing these pleas, they started firing again. As bullets zinged in the corridor, Lieutenant Kadavy managed to limp the short distance toward the staircase and turned the corner toward safety. His comrade was not as quick. He was seized halfway by a dagger-wielding rebel. "Your friend who tried to escape, we killed him," he growled. "If you try again, we'll kill you too." Then he shoved the captive officer further underground. Such prisoners were not the only non-combatants in the dark, fetid Kabu. Several women, including Muhammad Abdullah's wife and two sisters, had also fled downstairs and now tried to comfort their hungry, scared children. Dozens of pilgrims, some too sick or too old to move around, sat listlessly on the carpeted floor. One, an 80-year-old, quietly expired. One area of the basement became an improvised field hospital. Dripping feverish sweat, injured rebels and hostages slowly died there of infections that could have been cured with simple antibiotics. The rebels had no medication except for the holy waters of Zamzam. Samir, the teenage brother of two senior conspirators, was entrusted with applying generous quantities of this miraculous liquid to the ward's patients. While sufficient food was still available for the gunmen, those who didn't bear arms now had to survive on minimal rations, a dried date in the morning, another date in the evening, and some water in between. These physical privations, however, didn't distress the rebels and their supporters as much as the puzzling and worrying absence of Muhammad Abdullah, the Mahdi. The handful of gunmen who had witnessed the grenade explosion upstairs and who managed to reach the Kabu alive shared this disturbing piece of news with some of the most senior conspirators. Faisal Muhammad Faisal was shaken by the report. His belief in Juhayman's cause, weak even before the operation began, now evaporated completely. Why had he let himself be talked into joining this venture? Why hadn't he insisted on saying no to Juhayman during that cursed encounter at the farm in Amar? Seething, Faisal confronted Juhayman. "I think the Mahdi is dead," he began. Juhayman flew into a rage. These words were pure blasphemy. "You know well that the Mahdi cannot be killed," he shouted back. "He is not dead. He may have been captured, but he is not dead." Faisal stared back. Realizing that he could no longer convince his old comrade of the righteousness of their cause, Juhayman relented after a minute. He changed tack, speaking in a soft, complicit voice. "Whatever you do, don't tell the others," the rebel leader begged. Faisal nodded, put down his gun, and remained cloistered in a remote basement cell, praying for Allah's mercy. This was no longer his war. Despite Faisal's silence, glum rumors started to swirl among the ragtag band of rebels. If the Mahdi was not here among the believers, wasn't this whole operation now without a purpose? And if, God forbid, he was dead, didn't this mean that their glorious venture had turned out to be a terrible, terrible mistake? Hadn't it been promised in the Hadith that the Mahdi would be impervious to bullets and bombs? The faithful peppered Muhammad Abdullah's older brother, Sayyid, with questions. Were the death rumors correct? If so, what should be done with the Mahdi's body if it was found? The Muslim faith, after all, calls for an immediate burial. Sayyid responded that he did not know the answer to the first question, but he did not dither on the second count. "If you see him, don't bury him," he replied. "If my brother is the Mahdi, then Allah will take care of him. If he is not the Mahdi, we don't care about him anymore." This reply wasn't sufficient to reassure the besieged gunmen. Juhayman, the master himself, had to speak up. Sensing a potential revolt on his hands, the rebel leader finally left his room and stood up to face the believers. In this hour of reckoning, he deployed his best powers of persuasion. His eyes sparkled with anger. His loud, roaring voice echoed in the confined space. "How did the doubter's faith become so weak?" he bellowed. "How could anyone question God's clear commands? And what proof did anyone have of the Mahdi's death? The battle for justice on earth must go on." "If you want to leave, leave," Juhayman cried. "But I will stay here to fight until the end, even if I'm the only one who remains." Shamed and impressed by Juhayman's ardor, the potential dissidents lowered their eyes and withdrew to their posts. Indeed, it was no time to surrender, some mused. The Mahdi's defenders still had battles to fight. They were still inside the holy shrine. The war was not yet lost. And if their faith remained strong, God might still grant them victory. The Saudi government in these hours was just as puzzled as Juhayman's rebels about the precise fate of the man who proclaimed himself Mahdi. On Monday, November 26th, the Al-Madinah newspaper reported his arrest. But the next day, another Saudi newspaper, Al Jazeera, cited officials as denying that claim and saying that Mohammed Abdullah was not in government custody. As far as we know, he remains at large, doubtless in the basement of the mosque, the British ambassador, Sir James Craig, informed London in a confidential telegram. Reliable information was especially hard to come by because Saudi troopers, infuriated by massive casualties, shot on sight anyone who tried to surrender. In one incident that week, Prince Bandar told Ambassador West, the National Guard gunned down 6 of the 7 unarmed men who emerged from the depths of the mosque, their hands raised above their heads. The few rebels captured alive confused matters further. Every male prisoner claimed under interrogation that his name was Mohammed Abdullah. According to a rumor widely shared in Saudi Arabia, the real Mohammed Abdullah's mother was flown to Riyadh at the time for a meeting with King Khalid, who desired to find out in person about the royal family's most serious challenger in decades. Introduced to the monarch, the veiled woman allegedly spoke with Bedouin bluntness. "If my son is the Mahdi, he will kill you," she purportedly said. "If he is not, you will kill him." Chapter 20. As Saudi forces attempted to advance into the Kabu on Monday and Tuesday, they discovered that the rebels, shielded by darkness, were as lethal as ever. Trying to spare lives, shell-shocked military commanders decided to rely once again on the protection of M113 armored vehicles. These carriers could be driven underground through the access way that had been used by bin Laden's construction crews. Corporal Abdu Ali al-Jazani, a tall, dark-skinned man, was among a dozen soldiers packed into the lead APC that headed down this ramp. Barring their way was a GMC pickup truck that Juhayman's rebels had used to smuggle ammunition and supplies. The APC's driver hit the gas as he tried to ram the GMC and sweep it aside. Seconds later, the murky passageway was illuminated by a flash. The rebel pickup had been booby-trapped, and it burst into hissing flames that quickly engulfed the troop carrier. Smothering smoke filled the APC's inside compartments. Struggling for breath, coughing soldiers opened the rear armored door and began jumping out. Every single one was hit by well-aimed rebel bullets. Corporal Jazani, among the last men to hit the ground, felt the high-velocity lead rip his left leg in 3 different places. Lobbing 2 grenades toward the muzzle flashes, he managed to jump up and hobble away. The success of this ambush encouraged Juhayman's conspirators. Unlike the broad expanse of the Marwa Safa Gallery, the Kabu's narrow passageways severely limited the mobility of armored vehicles. This wasn't lost on Abdullah Mubarak Khatani, one of Juhayman's senior aides. A former military man, Khatani once served in the armored corps himself. He knew how to operate the M113s. "Wouldn't it be great," Khatani excitedly told Juhayman, "if we captured one of those machines and turned its guns against apostate forces?" Khatani even knew how to do it. The APCs could be immobilized in a narrow corridor by thrusting rolled-up carpets into the threads and by throwing another layer of smoldering carpets onto the roof to asphyxiate the crew. That was what the rebels tried to do as soon as another group of M113s rumbled deeper into the bowels of the Kabu. The ambush seemed to be working at first. Immobilized and covered by burning carpets, 2 or 3 armored troop carriers stalled in the pitch-black corridors, their crews struggling against noxious fumes. But as Khatani lunged toward the hatch, attempting to seize control of the lead vehicle, a bullet fired by one of the soldiers perforated his throat. Choking on his own blood and unable to speak, Khatani fell back, carmine foam gurgling out of the wound. Fellow rebels dragged him back to the improvised hospital, where he barely managed to scribble a short testament before passing away. No one else among the conspirators knew how to drive an APC. The tactic was abandoned. Though heavy fighting raged underground, the mosque's surface now was misleadingly tranquil. With bullets no longer flying from the minarets, cleanup work began. Traffic police hauled cranes to the neighborhood and started to remove abandoned cars, including the carbonized hulks of military vehicles. Sanitation teams sprayed disinfectant onto the sidewalks. Municipal workers in yellow uniforms collected the rotting garbage that had piled up everywhere. By Wednesday, November 28th, a handful of Saudi officers felt secure enough to finally pose for the cameras at an authorized photo op, offering prayers by the black stone of the Kaaba. These images were broadcast on TV. After more than a week of government lies about their being in control, the footage provided the world with the first undisputable proof that the Saudi regime had truly regained the shrine's holiest part. Any evidence of harm to the mosque was carefully cropped out. Foreign leaders, from the Italian Premier Francesco Cossiga to the Togolese dictator Nyasingbe Eyadema, responded by flooding Riyadh with congratulatory telegrams that lauded King Khalid for a successful end of the siege. But this pretense could hold up for only so long. With the rebels remaining in control of the Kaaba and potentially able to break out, the Grand Mosque remained a war zone, closed to ordinary worshippers. Every hour that such an interruption continued chipped away the prestige of the House of Saud, encouraging further dissent. The royal family knew that it sat atop a volcano. Waiting for Juhayman to run out of food and surrender was not an option. After a week of horrendously bloody combat, it was clear. The Saudi military needed help from abroad. Ministry of Defense hospitals around the country overflowed with the wounded. The number of injured and killed began to climb up to a dangerous percentage of the kingdom's entire armed forces, then numbering a total of just about 30,000 Saudi army soldiers and 20,000 members of the National Guard. Something had to be done. Fast. Any foreign assistance, of course, had to be as secret as possible. With astute timing, Tehran radio had notched up its revolutionary rhetoric that week, filling the airwaves with denunciations of the Saudi kingdom and pro-Western regimes in Morocco and Bahrain for a dependence on foreigners to protect their hollow monarchies. The Soviet news agency TASS had already transmitted a report, flatly denied by the Saudis, about the landing of American commandos at the military base in the eastern Saudi city of Dahran. Though it was true that American personnel were present in Dahran, this was part of an ongoing military cooperation unrelated to the Mecca crisis. Of all the potential military allies, nearby Jordan seemed the most natural choice for riding to al-Saud's rescue. A fellow conservative monarchy, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, while much smaller and poorer than Saudi Arabia, boasted a top-notch military that had been extensively trained by Britain. Just a few years earlier, Jordanian troops had fought in a bloody civil war, ousting Yasser Arafat's Palestinian guerrillas, who would try to take over the country. Already, Jordanian instructors worked with the Saudi National Guard under the auspices of the U.S. military training mission. Battle-tested Jordanian soldiers were fellow Arabs and Muslims, which meant that they could easily enter Mecca unnoticed by outsiders. The Jordanians, wedged uncomfortably between Israel and Iraq, had gone into near panic at the first reports that their only pro-Western Arab neighbor was in trouble. Unable to get any hard information from within Saudi Arabia, senior Jordanian officials peppered the U.S. government with requests for intelligence. Lieutenant General Zaid bin Shaker, commander general of the Jordanian military forces, told American diplomats in those days that he had engaged in almost frantic efforts to activate a link with Prince Turki's GID and that he was unable to reach any senior Saudi prince. Once King Hussein finally managed to speak to the Saudi monarch, he offered any help needed, including the use of the Jordanian military. Elite Jordanian commandos, led by Tahsin Shordom, an officer of Circassian origin, were gathered at the Markham military airport near Amman, ready to fly to Mecca on a moment's notice. But the commandos remained on hold. King Hussein and General bin Shaker were invited to Riyadh only a week into the crisis. The Jordanian king badly wanted to meet there with the key Saudi decision-makers, Crown Prince Fahd and Defense Minister Prince Sultan, but the two were still away from Riyadh, too busy to talk with foreigners. Dressed in a bespoke suit and a tie, the Jordanian ruler had to make do with meeting King Khalid and the Saudi National Guard commander, Prince Abdullah. The Saudi monarch greeted his guest in a traditional Arab headdress and dark shawl and, as King Hussein later remarked, was unfailing in his courtesies. But the Saudis balked at accepting Jordanian assistance for a very obvious reason. As the two kings exchanged pleasantries and rejoiced in mutual sympathy, they were acutely aware of just how the Saudis had come to rule Mecca in the first place. Back in 1924, King Khaled's father had unleashed a war of aggression against King Hussein's great-grandfather and namesake, the Hashemite Sharif of Mecca and King of Hejaz. For Riyadh, it would have been an unacceptable loss of face to rely on, of all people, the defeated Hashemites to win back Islam's holiest shrine. King Khaled proved to be surprisingly frank in discussing with King Hussein the persistent differences between the Hejaz and al-Saud's heartland of the Nejd. The Saudi king confided he was thankful that Juhayman's rebels, most of whom hailed from the Nejd, had chosen to strike in the Hashemites' former domain, where the Nejd brand of Islamic radicalism enjoyed little sympathy. Had they attacked in the Nejd itself, he said, it would have been much more dangerous. Viewed from this perspective, any Jordanian military operation in the Hejaz was equally fraught with perils. The Saudis suggested, not altogether without reason, that the Hashemites had never really accepted their loss of Mecca and still nurtured dreams of a revanche. King Hussein made such feelings painfully clear after returning to Amman. The Hejazis, he complained ruefully to the American ambassador, were considered second-class citizens by the ruling authorities, and the feelings of Hejazi resentment were bound to be exacerbated by the Mecca affair. The last thing the House of Saud wanted to see was an upsurge in Hejazi separatism, which would be inevitable should the Hashemites cover themselves with glory as liberators of the Grand Mosque. As one Saudi officer put it, the fear was, if the Jordanians come to Mecca, they will never leave. Such concerns obviously didn't arise with Riyadh's Western allies, which, by virtue of being Western, could not challenge Saudi Arabia's status as the sole custodian of Islamic orthodoxy and of Islam's holy sites. Of these allies, the United States was by far the most important. The CIA already ran an assistance program in Taif, and would have been a partner of choice in different times. But Prince Turki, the Saudi intelligence chief, was ambivalent. He felt that the American spy agency had been emasculated by strict congressional restrictions, and that its operational capacity had been largely destroyed under the Carter administration. Unnervingly, the CIA also couldn't keep secrets secret. Earlier in 1979, its Saudi station chief, George Cave, had been personally expelled by Prince Turki. Because of infighting within the Carter administration, Cave's classified report to Langley that laid bare internal divisions within the Saudi royal family had been leaked to the American press, causing much embarrassment to the House of Saud. Given the drumbeat of anti-American propaganda streaming from Tehran, leaks of CIA involvement in Mecca would have produced far more disastrous consequences. While Prince Turki demurred from involving the CIA mission, the Saudi Ministry of Defense on Tuesday, November 27th, made an urgent request to the U.S. government. It wanted potent tear gas and smoke equipment that could be used by assault teams in the Kabu catacombs. According to American officials, this request was forwarded to the CIA station, which had stockpiled precisely this kind of gas and equipment for the training of Saudi forces at the Taif facility. The Americans also supplied blood, which had begun to run out in Saudi military hospitals. Not being Muslim, CIA operatives theoretically could not enter Mecca. A quick conversion of the kind that had been administered to American helicopter pilots appeared to have remedied this problem. The agency's spooks made a rapid tour of the battlefield. The tear gas, in non-lethal concentrations, was hauled to Mecca and put into action. Because any active involvement by the CIA in combat required a presidential finding, the agency's role was limited to what could reasonably be passed for liaison and advice. This resort to chemical warfare, by the account of Saudi soldiers inside the Grand Mosque, proved a complete fiasco. Hardened rebels shielded themselves with old mattresses and pieces of cardboard and cloth, blocking the passageways and preventing the gases spread through narrow underground corridors. Water-soaked headdresses effectively protected their breathing. Hiding in the darkness below, the rebels also easily made out the silhouettes of soldiers who approached the openings above and skewered the troops with well-aimed salvos. Laws of nature were on Juhayman's side, too. The operations planners didn't foresee that the American-provided gas had a natural tendency to rise. When fired into the basement, it quickly wafted back to the surface floors and to the mosque's courtyard. There, only the better-trained troops knew how to properly use their gas masks. Many among ordinary Saudi soldiers wore bushy beards, and their abundant facial hair prevented the masks from sealing on the skin. Gas filtered in through the beards, and it was the Saudi soldiers, not Juhayman's zealots, who became most incapacitated by the chemicals, collapsing in bouts of vomiting and gasping for air. The gas also rapidly drifted to nearby neighborhoods. In the Africa Hotel, where Professor Mattani was trapped, the wind blew in such a strong dose that the manager fell on the floor, unable to move. People on several street blocks, including, to their relief, Mattani and other residents of the hotel, had to be evacuated for days because of the toxic cloud that continued to hang over the area. Prince Turki came to a realization. He had to seek more competent help. Chapter 21. Just 2 months before the siege started in Mecca, the unsuspecting Emperor Bokassa I had arrived on a state visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. An on-and-off convert to Islam, the emperor, born Jean Bedel, ruled a dirt-poor and landlocked African country on the right bank of the Congo. His Central African Empire, known in French colonial times as Ubangi-Chari, was desperately strapped for cash. Libya's erratic dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, had already developed a habit of doling out Libya's oil money to fawning African rulers. Bokassa figured he'd get his share by parroting Gaddafi's anti-Western rhetoric. A despot, unusually cruel even by African standards, Bokassa, a former French army captain, had lived off French subsidies for years. As long as he remained pliant to French wishes, nobody in Paris specially minded about his reputed proclivity for cooking and eating political opponents. But now, in the fall of 1979, with Libya on the brink of an open war with French-backed forces in nearby Chad, French patience snapped. Under cover of darkness, two plane loads of French special forces landed in the Empire's ramshackle capital, Bangui. Using loudspeakers, French soldiers stunned Central African soldiers in the airport by addressing them in their local dialect. Then they hauled out boxloads of fresh cash for the troops. The capital was seized without a single bullet being fired. The man who organized this daring operation, kept secret even from France's own foreign ministry, was Count Alexandre de Maranche, the balding, mustachioed boss of France's intelligence agency called Service de Documentation Extérieure et de Contre-Espionnage, or SDECE. Born to an American socialite mother and a French general who had served as General Pershing's aide-de-camp in World War I, de Maranche was a devoted Cold Warrior. An early volunteer with anti-Nazi French forces in World War II, he had served as French liaison to the U.S. Chief of Staff, General George Marshall. For him, the Atlantic alliance with America was sacrosanct. In a reversal of their familiar positions in the early 21st century, France's elite at the time firmly believed in using military force and protecting national interests, as the ousted Emperor Bokassa could testify. The conservative government of President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing looked with disdain at Carter's moralistic endeavors and was aghast at American impotence in Iran. America's bizarre new inclination to turn the other cheek, in de Maranche's view, was little short of a betrayal of Western ideals. The French count, who would greatly admire Ronald Reagan, scornfully referred to Carter as that baby-faced Boy Scout. As head of the SDECE, de Maranche had long paid great attention to Saudi Arabia, traveling there throughout the years and nurturing a friendship with King Faisal and his successors. In the early days of that outreach, Saudi Arabia was fully dependent on the United States. So much so that communications between the French spy and the Saudi royals had to be handled by American telecommunications officers attached to Aramco, the oil company. De Maranche doggedly worked on rectifying this imbalance. He employed an SDECE station chief in the kingdom, a certain Colonel C., a Camel Corps officer who had spent years in the Sahara and was fluent in Arabic. The colonel, according to de Maranche, had developed profound relationships with senior Saudi princes. through a long evening spent sipping tea in a tent around a campfire, fueled with camel dung. All this tea-sipping paid off. Toward the end of the 1970s, France flanked America as a major provider of weaponry to the kingdom, selling the Saudis its AMX tanks and providing training to scores of Saudi officers and special force troops near Toulon. Prince Turki first met the French spymaster when de Morange visited with his father, King Faisal, in 1974. An enormous man whose bulging belly could never be contained by a belt, de Morange was hilariously funny and charming when he needed to make friends. Turki thought him extraordinary, and after becoming head of Saudi intelligence in 1977, Turki established with de Morange's SDECE a powerful covert action alliance, filling a vacuum that the CIA's incapacitation had left in the region. This alliance, which also included spy agencies of pro-Western Egypt, Morocco, and until the Islamic Revolution, Iran, called itself the Safari Club. As CIA officers enviously watched its exploits, the Safari Club busied itself with cloak-and-dagger operations from Somalia to Zaire. Though the first non-lethal CIA aid for Afghan guerrillas began to trickle in only in July 1979, it was the Safari Club that began pouring money and weapons into a fledgling Islamic insurgency there soon after the communist takeover of April 1978. Because of these tight connections with Paris, as well as a genuine admiration for the French Count, it was only natural for Prince Turki to pick up the phone and call de Morange for advice a few days into the Grand Mosque crisis. What kind of assistance, the Saudi prince wanted to know, could be offered by Paris? "We are at your service," the French spymaster replied. "What can we do?" "Discreet professional help would be much appreciated," Prince Turki replied. De Morange had already given some thought to the upheaval in Mecca, and he realized the immense religious importance of the shrine. He watched American interests attacked in previous days all over the Muslim world because of mere rumors of U.S. involvement in the affair. Was it really necessary to commit non-Muslim French soldiers to such a sensitive mission? Only a purely Islamic force, he suggested to Turki, could intervene in a precinct as sacred as the Kaaba. As it happened, another of Saudi Arabia's traditional Safari Club partners was eager to help. Morocco's royal protocol chief, General Moulay Al-Alawi, had just flown to Jeddah with a proposal to dispatch to Mecca several hundred French-trained commandos of Morocco's Gendarme Royal. But the Saudis had no desire to become indebted to fellow Arabs. If they wanted to solicit the Jordanians or the Moroccans, they could have asked them directly. What Saudi Arabia required in these dangerous times was the high expertise and absolute discretion that, senior princes believed, only the French could provide. Shortly after this conversation, President Giscard d'Estaing followed up with a formal overture. He passed a personal message to King Khalid. France was outraged by the desecration of the holy shrine, and, should His Majesty so request, was ready to provide assistance, having some experience in the matter. The response from Riyadh was almost immediate. "How soon can you come?" To preserve utmost secrecy, top French and Saudi officials from then on talked directly to each other, bypassing normal diplomatic channels. The French embassy in Jeddah, and even the country's foreign minister, were kept out of the loop, with communications entrusted to the head of the French military cooperation mission in Riyadh, General Hervé Navarro. Having read the desperate-sounding Saudi reply, General Navarro boarded a plane that same day and rushed to Paris for an emergency meeting in the Élysée Presidential Palace. The crisis he was leaving behind was about to get dramatically more complicated.